This episode of the Slow Melt Maker Series is sponsored by Cacao Cucina, the control you need to craft your chocolate. Reliable chocolate making machinery built in the USA. Use Slow Melt 10 at cacaocucina.com. Contact us for a 10% discount through September 1st. This episode is also supported by Chocolate Alchemy, supplier of the largest selection of fine flavor cocoa beans, chocolate making equipment, and volumes of free chocolate making information. They've been helping home chocolate makers and bean-to-bar professionals for over 14 years. Visit chocolatealchemy.com and enter SLOWMELT at checkout to receive 10% off any retail cocoa bean order.
Welcome to the Slow Melt Maker Series. I'm Simran Sethi, and today I'm speaking with Robbie Stout, the co-founder of Ritual Chocolate, based in Park City, Utah, here in the United States. Robbie, I'm chatting with you from Denver, which is the place where we first met a couple of years ago, but Ritual was actually born in Boulder, right?
Yes, we started in Boulder, really just in our apartment, like our studio apartment. We'd have to listen to our grinder all night. It was kind of miserable. But after about a year of doing that, we were able to connect with Steve DeVries in Denver, and we eventually moved to Denver, where we really launched the business. So, yeah.
Who's the we?
So Anna and I, my girlfriend.
Yeah. So let's back up a little bit. I want to know why chocolate?
Well, at the time, we were both, you know, we just met. We met in 2008 in the fall, and I think by February of 2009, we decided we wanted to start a business together. I think we just really liked each other, and we're just like, how can we spend more time together? We both worked at coffee shops. We were into cheese. We were into wine. And it was actually through her brother in San Francisco that we got introduced to fine chocolate. We tasted, I can't even remember which bars we tasted, somewhere from Europe. I think there was a couple U.S. chocolates in there, and they were all single origin. And they weren't particularly out of this world good, but they were interesting. And it was enough for us to kind of trigger that light bulb and just kind of get really excited about the concept. And, you know, we went back to Boulder, and we realized that, you know, no matter where we went, the grocery store, you know, the specialty store, no one was really carrying like what I would define as fine chocolate. Back then, we were paying, you know, $2 to $3 a bar for like a Choco Love bar, and that was like our go-to. And we didn't really realize better quality was possible. And so once we started doing our homework and got a little bit exposed to some fine chocolates, we just kind of fell in love with the concept. One of the first things we said back then was it'd be awesome to just do a project where we could dump all of our values into it and don't take any shortcuts, just do it right. And that was kind of like what got us going.
Awesome.
Yeah, we just kept taking baby steps, and now here we are today in Park City.
Tell me a little bit about your work with Steve DeVries. How did meeting Steve DeVries, who has been working in craft chocolate for a long time, and moving to Denver, Colorado, help expand Ritual?
Well, we got started the way that, you know, most small bean-to-bar chocolate makers get started. We bought a 10-pound Santa. We were just tinkering at home, building our own little winnowers and trying to, you know, figure it out ourselves. And then meeting Steve, that gave us access to real chocolate equipment. So, you know, a real winnower, a roll mill, which was, you know, amazing for texture, and an actual conch that was designed for, you know, conching chocolate and not for making like Indian curries and sauces.
Explain what conching chocolate is.
it's all about aeration from all this movement and splashing. What we're really trying to do is evaporate acidity and whatever moisture might still be in there to help bring the chocolate down to a point that it's just has that perfect flavor, because cacao is often really acidic, and the conching helps to minimize that acidity a bit and to sort of narrow down those ideal flavors. But then from a texture perspective, there is some particle polishing, because you know, when we refine the chocolate in the roll mill, a lot of the particles come out pretty flat. And ideally, what we'd like to see after conching is for these, you know, microscopic particles to be more of like a round shape that'll be sort of softer on your tongue. But also, just the dispersion of fats and solids. And when that happens, the chocolate starts to flow really well. And you kind of see the change. It goes from being pretty thick to flowing like water, that nice flowing consistency.
Beautiful. Now, I want to hone in on the term you just used. You described Ritual as a bean-to-bar company. Tell me a little bit about the definitions that you use to describe what the company is and who you are.
You know, we are a bean-to-bar chocolate company, but, you know, so is Mars, so is Hershey. We are craft chocolate. We're a small batch. We are not able to invest in, you know, million-dollar machines to automate our process. And so that means getting really creative, really crafty, figuring out problems, and, you know, maybe building a piece of equipment or maybe modifying a pre-existing one. And then the whole concept of fine chocolate, I think we fall into that category too, because we're really trying to produce the highest quality chocolate possible. And that's what I really like about the fine chocolate term, is because it is referring to the quality of the chocolate, you know, quality cacao, you know, the best process that we know how to do, and really just making the best chocolate we know how to make.
I really like that term. I mean, I spoke to you when I was working on a piece for the Washington Post about the definition of bean to bar and exactly what you said. You know, it doesn't say anything about quality. It really is a term that can be used for any chocolate company that has some oversight. So Hershey's, Mars, Nestle, also bean to bar, and Ritual is bean to bar, but Ritual isn't Hershey, Mars, or Nestle. And what you're saying right now is fine seems to be closer, and that seems like a really good definition, which is, of course, in the vacuum of the fact that no real definitions exist. So everyone can kind of still define in whatever way feels right for them.
Yeah, and I wouldn't really want any of those definitions to sort of kind of get in the way of another definition. Uh-huh. So like if there's a machine that I find that I believe is going to make amazing chocolate, but it's not very craft, you know, it doesn't mean we shouldn't use it, because at the end of the day, we're trying to make the best chocolate possible. You know, we're not really just doing this so we can struggle. You know, we're trying to, you know, make good chocolate. That's our goal.
Yeah. Where do you source your beans from?
At the moment, we source cacao from Peru, Venezuela, Belize, Ecuador, and Madagascar.
And why have you chosen these origins? From the mind and heart of a maker, what are you looking for when you source from particular origins?
An origin for us has to be well-rounded. You know, if it has the most amazing flavor, but let's say, you know, we don't like the farming practices, or the price is too high, or just we don't have a good relationship or something with the farm manager, or it's a long-term relationship, there's always going to be companies that have, you know, more, you know, finances than we do, that could always, you know, buy our supply out from under us. And so, you know, we definitely believe that having strong relationships will at least help us ensure that we can purchase cacao down the road. And so we like to make sure that all of our origins tick kind of all the boxes, whether it's farmed organically, whether everyone who participates on the farm or even in the co-op is happy and it's like has a positive impact on the community. And then, of course, the quality has to be there, genetically speaking, or just from a fermentation and drying standpoint. the way that we make chocolate, we can't really hide flavor. Mm-hmm. It's a very pure way of making chocolate. So the cacao, you know, if it has any defects, you know, you're going to taste it in the chocolate. So,
and is that because you're working with such minimal ingredients, you know, which is basically two, sugar and cacao, or is it for another reason?
Yeah, I mean, the simplicity of our chocolate, the flavor you taste is the cacao. So if the flavor is bad, the chocolate will be bad. And if the flavor is good, the chocolate will be good. And, you know, I think if we were making like a milk chocolate or a much higher, let's say, just sugar content chocolate, you know, the beans would be, I guess, less important. But really, you would still pick up on those off flavors.
One of the things you just mentioned was organic cocoa beans. And you use organic beans, but you're not certified organic.
Whenever possible, we'll try to buy certified organic. But when it comes to cacao, I don't want to let a certification get in the way of, you know, the best flavor possible. So that doesn't mean we want to buy from farms that are using pesticides and are not farming organically. It's just that a lot of the best farms or the best genetic regions in the world, you know, they're so small, they're so poor, you know, they're not really going to be farming inorganically, but they're not going to pay for that certification either. And I wouldn't want to let that get in the way of us, you know, sourcing from these areas. And once you bring in non-organic certified ingredients into the factory, you know, you pretty much can't be an organic company at that point.
That's really good to know. Would the other certifications fall into kind of the same realm?
Yeah, I mean, I think some certifications are great. I often say that, you know, they prevent the worst case scenario from happening, which is always a good thing. But they often also add a lot of costs, sometimes at the expense of the farmer. And it's just like, you know, I'd rather, if we're paying more, I'd rather that money goes straight to the people who are growing it. Because I don't know, I think the biggest problem we're going to start to see is having a lack of farmers who want to grow cacao. I mean, it's already happened a lot. And I think to keep farmers in the game, we're going to have to just keep, you know, paying higher and higher prices. And I don't really want a certification to take away from that.
This episode is brought to you by Rotar Chocolate Machines, a chocolate grinder designed and built by a chocolate maker for chocolate makers and made in the United States. Get all of the details at www.rotar.com. This episode is also brought to you by Blue Apron, the meal delivery service that works directly with artisanal purveyors and family-run farms to bring meals to your door. Get $30 off your first order plus free shipping at blueapron.com/chocolate.
Let's get back to this bar, your Marañón bar. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about this bar.
Well, so back in 2010, there had just been some recent discoveries of, you know, some lost cacao genetics in Peru. This was, I think the discovery was in 2008 or 2009. And Steve at the time had gone down to Peru to help just sort of investigate and kind of help set up fermentation and drying and give this sort of family business a good idea of the steps to take to process high quality cacao. And they brought back a sample, and Anna and I were lucky enough to try this extremely small sample of this cacao. It was in chocolate form at this time. I remember Steve just had like this like 5-pound block float around the factory for like a while. To us at the time, it was just the best chocolate we'd ever tried. I mean, the flavors were just so cool. Really blew our minds. And so when we got started, one of our first emails was to this company, which is Marañón Cacao, which is two sons and a father company. And we said, hey, we'd like to buy beans. We really love your cacao. But at the time, they were only selling chocolate. So they were shipping their cacao to Switzerland. It was being made into couverture. And then that chocolate was being sold to chocolatiers all around the world. And so for a couple of years, it felt like we were just kind of begging. We were like, can we please buy cacao? we met Adam and Dan at the Northwest Chocolate Festival. I think that was 2012.
And Adam and Dan are?
Dan is the father. Adam's one of the sons. And they are the two of the three founders of Marañón Cacao. And we were able to just like give them some of our chocolate at this festival to say, hey, like try our chocolate. We do a really good job. I think we could do a great job with your beans. And so they tried our chocolate. They loved it. A year later, we got a message saying, hey, like, do you still want to buy cacao? And we were like, absolutely. Like, and so we were the first company to buy cocoa beans from Marañón. And that was just like, that felt like it was 3 years in the making just because we'd been sort of like lusting after this origin for so long. The beans are the cleanest I have ever seen. There's no like broken beans or like sticks or rocks or, all sorts of stuff you sometimes find in bags. It's got the highest fat content that I've ever seen in any bean. And so when we work with it, it just like flows like water. And
actually, before we talk about fat, let's talk about design. This is a relatively new design of the Ritual Bar, right?
Yeah, this packaging is about a year and a half old. We felt like we wanted to change things up a bit and have a design that reflects our company and who we are a bit better. This new design is a bit more fun. It's also a bit more representative of where we are in Utah. It has a bit of like the, what I would call like the Navajo deco design. but also, within the packaging, we have like a image of Park City. We have an image, of the factory, and then we have an image of the farm. And we're really just trying to highlight the people who make it, where we are kind of in the world. We're kind of 7,000 feet in the mountains.
Yeah.
In our little factory.
Is it a little factory? What's the size of your operations? How many people are working with you?
Yeah, we have a small factory. I mean, it's a 3,000 square foot building, but almost a third of it is dedicated to our cafe. So really, we're only producing and shipping and all of that in a little over 2,000 square feet. And that's pretty small. I mean, it's pretty hard to just even roll a pallet around inside. I mean, it's tight. But we have, on any given day, we might have three or four production employees working. Not full-time, just sort of maybe 4 hours here, 4 hours there. I'm still very active in production. Anna is still very active in shipping and account management. And but then we also have the cafe where there's two or three people working each day. So I think in total we have about 15 employees, but most of them are part-time.
I'm breaking a piece off this bar. Tell me what flavors I should expect as I move this closer to my nose and mouth.
Well, this is a bar that we often define as distinctly aromatic. Mm-hmm. It really has a strong just aroma. It's surprising. I mean, I think of all of our chocolate, I open it and it's just like this sort of burst of aroma. I think it's got some nice floral aromas. Once again, the really high fat content. Mm-hmm. So
right.
When you start to taste it, it's going to be extremely buttery and smooth and sort of soft. And it's not a particularly chocolatey chocolate. It's not very fudgy.
Yeah.
It's a very light flavor. I often describe it as like roasted nuts or peanuts, but also just like some light sort of apricot and stone fruit fruit flavors that come through.
Totally.
And as I taste it, with this one, I really like to do the whole retro nasal sort of breath, where you sort of breathe out through your nose and start to kind of pick up on those kind of nutty floral flavors.
There's such a range of flavors in the world, and it's so interesting to think like, yeah, I can pick up on that. For me, it's like dried apricot, and maybe not the peanut itself, but the skin around the nut.
Right. Yeah.
It's amazing how specific we can get,
right,
and how
right.
like I'm not picking up on any of those fudgy notes. Like, it's exactly what you said. This is like an unchocolate bar.
Right. Right. I think a lot of that has to do with just the amount of fat. I mean, the more fat you have, the less non-fat cocoa solids you have. So the less like flavor contributing solids are going to be there in terms of the ratio.
Let's talk about the cocoa bean for a minute. It's typically roughly 50% cocoa nib, which is what would give us that chocolatey flavor, and then fat, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. I think the best way to define it is you have your cocoa solids as the umbrella definition, and then you have which can either be fat or it can be your non-fat cocoa solids, and so that's like the what I would call like the cocoa powder portion of a nib.
Okay.
And for a chocolate like this, I mean, just the fat is off the charts. I can't even describe it. I don't know the actual percentage. If I had to guess, I'd say it's like 60% fat. I mean, it's off the charts. Around 40% of these beans, they're like a whitish color. So, you know, in the pod, there'll be that sort of pure white color. After fermentation, they're more of like a light brown color. And so that gives you a chocolate that's going to be lighter in color, you know, like kind of like a light sandstone color. And yeah, there's a lot to be said about white beans. You know, it's sort of fuzzy science at this point. You know, they are missing some of those tannin molecules. So in theory, these whiter beans should be less bitter, lower in tannins, and sort of smoother. And that's one of the attractions to white beans is the concept of just like a light, kind of just mellow tasting chocolate. Because really, cacao is just such a strong flavor. I mean, it's one of the strongest flavors out there. It's just, when it's in its purest form, it's just like a punch in the mouth almost, you know? And so if it can be naturally mellow, that's just, you know, pretty fascinating.
And when I think of tannins, I always think of astringency, and this is like velvet in my mouth. This is a really nice texture.
Yeah, well, the texture is also due to our process. So roll milling in a 3-roll mill, and then a full 3-day conch in a, you know, 100-year-old longitudinal conch. And so really, the texture should be, you know, spot on. Yeah.
For this mouth, it is.
Yeah, good.
What do you wish chocolate lovers better understood about chocolate and chocolate making?
You know, it's sad to me that, you know, most people look at chocolate as like a cheap food. But that is just so far from the truth. And the only reason it is cheap is because people are getting kind of hurt in the process. So I really wish like people understood like, okay, look, people are growing this, you know, and those people have to make a living somehow. And, you know, the only way to make a living is to be paid a decent wage. And then not only that side of things, but, you know, really all cacao is going to be pretty different, or at least has the potential to be different. If you treat something poorly, it's going to, you know, be standard. It's going to be poor quality, and that's kind of just the commodities market. It's all done by weight. It's not necessarily a measurement of quality, and so really these, you know, co-ops or farms, you know, they're just seeing a price per pound, and that's it, and no mention of quality, and so there's no incentive to really produce anything better or to try to do better. And it's funny because like some of these co-ops, like they might not know it, but they might have some of the coolest, you know, genetics out there. And that's exactly what happened in Peru. I mean, this was a pre-existing sort of growing community, you know, and they didn't know that they had some of the best genetics in the world. And they were, you know, fermenting it poorly, drying it poorly, selling it to the local middleman for next to nothing. And then that middleman was then selling it to another sort of exporter for next to nothing. And that was going to the big companies. And it was just like, you know, here's these amazing genetics just going into like a sort of a tasteless milk chocolate bar. And, you know, each origin has the potential, even with bad genetics, mm-hmm. to be good. I think, you know, through fermentation, through drying, there's always room for improvement. And, you know, farmers could see that come back in terms of a higher, sort of higher wage or higher value if they, they're incentivized to do so. And then the other thing I wish kind of customers understood is that, you know, making chocolate really well is difficult, and it is a skill. It's a craft. It's a very like intentional, you know, process. I guess it's kind of like a misunderstood food. You know, when we got into chocolate, all I knew about chocolate was that it was like brown, and I think it came from Belgium. You know, like, you know, I really knew nothing before we got started.
What was the epiphanic moment in that process when you realized it wasn't just something brown?
I think it was probably one of those Madagascar moments, you know, just to taste all that fruit and all that sort of nuttiness and none of the typical chocolate bitterness. It was just like, whoa, like this tastes like there's strawberries in there, or there's limes or something. And it's just, you know, to have that moment of just like, oh my God, like, I can't believe what I'm tasting. Like, this is, you know, this is chocolate. and just chocolate, right? There's no other ingredients. So even to this day, you know, we give factory tours and we have a cafe. And when we're really trying to, like, hit that, you know, send that message to a new customer that's learning about single origin chocolate, we'll often just say, hey, try this Madagascar, you know. And then we'll be like, oh, and then try the Ecuador next. There's only, you know, cacao in there, and that's what you're tasting. And to have that like aha moment of like, wow, like this is just two different origins and they taste like completely different foods.
Yeah. And it's a passport to the world. Like, where am I going today? Oh, Peru. Okay. Okay. So what's your advice to fledgling makers? Mm-hmm. Like, what do you wish you had known before you got started?
It's going to be twice as hard as you expect. Actually, no, 10 times harder. It's also going to cost 10 times more than you might expect. But also, you know, if Anna and I can be where we are today, then anyone else can. And we really started as small as it gets. I mean, I sold like my drum set to buy like the Santha, you know, I like just sort of tinkered with a chicken rotisserie oven to make a roaster. And you know, we really started small. And even when we moved in to Steve's factory in Denver, I mean, we didn't have any money. Like, we still worked at a coffee shop, you know, like coffee shop wages with no savings. And that's how we got started. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, you know, we've taken baby steps. We've just slowly grown. You know, in the beginning, we did a lot of the design ourselves, and I don't think we had any employees for the first three and a half years. If you keep going and kind of roll with the punches, you'll get somewhere. it's not going to be easy, but eventually, you know, a bank might give you a loan. You know, that took us 4 years to get a bank loan, and that was, you know, we were actually profitable our first few years just because. You know, we didn't have any employees. We did all the work ourselves. We weren't paying ourselves. And so all the money went back into the business. And, you know, the margins are a lot better when you look at it like that. But, yeah, it's just, you know, it's a long, hard road, and it's definitely not any easier now. It doesn't get easier. And actually, the bigger you get, the harder it gets. So
why do you keep doing it?
Let's see. Why do we keep doing it? let's see. It's not for the money.
The fame?
No, it's not the fame, that's for sure. If I want to get famous, I'd probably like be a beer brewer or something like that. Something fun like that. you know, we're just really dedicated to the craft itself. I know that we're both personally obsessed with improving and perfecting, and we're not even really type A people, you know. I'd say we're like type B, you know. We like to relax, you know, we like to have our free time, but at the same time, you know, we're also pretty obsessed just with the process of making chocolate, improving that, making it more efficient. You know, we haven't been able to launch many new bars lately, just because of financial reasons. It's expensive to do that. But we're actually about to release a few, and it's really exciting just to like think about new things we can release and new origins that we can work with. And I mean, this year especially, we finally, after a long time, were able to go down to origin. We went down to Peru, and to be, you know, after being in the business so long, to then sort of see it in person again and kind of like see the people growing it and the trees, and it really was exciting and definitely motivated us to just keep going. And it makes you feel good about what you're doing. I mean, just it's such a cool crop. It's genetically interesting, culturally interesting. The process is just fascinating. And it's, you know, it tastes good. It's like this awesome, tasty food, you know, like there's no watering it down. Yeah. You know, there's no shortcuts to good chocolate. It's just, I don't know. I like the authenticity of it.
I'm in total agreement. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Robbie.
Yeah, thank you.
Podcast listeners, you can learn more about Ritual Chocolate on their website, ritualchocolate.com. Use the code SLOWMELT for a discount on all items in the Ritual line. You can also order the Maker Series Tasting Pack, featuring all 9 of the bars we're tasting across this series, exclusively through chocolopolis.com. Check our website, theslowmelt.com, for all details, discount information, and the dates of this promotion. To hear shows on how the money consumers pay for chocolate is allocated and more musings on craft chocolate definitions, go to our website or look for us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and other podcast platforms. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at The Slow Melt. The Slow Melt Maker Series is mixed and produced by Katie Ranke with guidance from Sean Corey Campbell and written and edited by me, Simran Sethi, with support from Sasha Woodruff. Our title track, Soldier, is written and performed by The Slackers. Join us week after next for a Maker Series episode featuring Maru and a tasting session that takes us to Vietnam. And if you like what you're hearing, please tell your friends, consider giving us a review or donating, and subscribe through your favorite podcast app. Choco love and thanks for all your support.